But when I was in college, I majored in philosophy, and I was one of those students that came in as a philosophy student, and I left as a philosophy student. I didn't change my major a million times along the way. The reason why I majored in philosophy was because I knew that from my freshman year in high school, I wanted to become a pastor. So basically, I'm living my dream job. And but my when senior year rolled around, I knew that I needed to pick a major that would allow me to have some flexibility just in case this whole ministry thing didn't pan out. And so I chose philosophy because I was involved in this particular group called Mock Trial. I don't know if you've ever heard of Mock Trial. High school students might know. And I loved being a part of that. Basically, what Mock Trial is that you play out a fictitious trial, and you play both the lawyer and you play the witnesses, and you bring a group, and you compete against other high schools, and you're judged based upon your performance as either a lawyer, in the lawyer sense, and then also a witness, how well you testify. And then also you're judged based upon your actual performance as an actor. And based upon the tally points, you either win or you move on or you lose. And so because I fell in love with Mock Trial my senior year, I also wanted, I thought of becoming a criminal prosecutor. And so I did some research, and I learned that philosophy students do the best on the LSATs, which is the kind of like the test to get into law school. And I learned that the reason why they do the best on the LSATs is because I guess philosophy students are involved in a lot of logic, arguing with one another. And so I guess that's what the LSATs are all about. And so I chose philosophy for that particular reason, because I grew a love for law, particularly criminal law. And growing up, I also loved this particular TV show called Law and Order, which is still going on. Not the original Law and Order, just the SVU Special Victims Unit. And I always, watching Law and Order, I always wanted to go up to the witness, you know, and put my leg up on the stand there, ask them a question, and then like, tell me the truth. What did you do on that particular day? You know, I wanted to yell at them basically. And but I realized, I mean, you're not allowed to approach the witness like that in a real trial. So I realized it was just you know, daydreaming. But you know, I get to live out my daydream now because I'm a youth pastor, and I basically, while I don't interrogate criminals, I get to interrogate youth students. So, you can't have everything, but it's close enough. So one of the things that I learned during my time being a process of being in mock trial, and as I learned more about law, is that it's not just about the facts in a particular case that win these trials. It's also the presentation of the facts that help you win the trials. Because if it were just about the facts, then all lawyers would be created equal, right? Because you have the facts, you just present it, and then you either win or lose, or you are prosecuted or not, or you're convicted or not, you go to jail or not. But that's not how it really works. I mean, there are lawyers who get paid millions and millions of dollars per hour, right, for what they do, and there are those that can't earn a buck, right? And the reason for that is because there are some lawyers that take the facts and are able to articulate and present these facts before a jury and the judge to be able to give their clients the best chance possible in order to win it, whether it's in a criminal trial or a civil trial or whatever it might be. And so it's not just about the facts itself, but it's also the presentation of those facts that help you win a particular case. And while many of us, okay, and probably not none of us here, will never experience a court trial because of our faith, the truth of the matter is that our faith is always on trial, right? Our faith is always on trial of public opinion or friends' opinions or family opinions. And so what we want to do today is we want to learn from Paul's response as he is on trial for his beliefs, his trial before Felix in today's passage. And as we see his response, we want to see what it takes to be a righteous witness. What it takes to be a righteous witness. So let's continue in our study in Acts and open up our Bibles to Acts chapter 24. And we're going to look at the whole chapter there. Acts chapter 24, verses 1 through 27. And if you don't have a Bible with you, there should be Bibles in the pockets in the seat in front of you for you to use today. And if you don't own a Bible, you can take that home with you. So Acts chapter 24, verses 1 through 27. So starting from verse 1. After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus. They laid before the governor their case against Paul. And when he had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, "Since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation. In every way and everywhere, we accept this with all gratitude. But to detain you no further, I beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly. For we have found this man a plague, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world, and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, but we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to find out from him everything of which we accuse him." The Jews also joined in the charge, affirming that all these things were so. Yeah, he's right. Amen. And when the governor had nodded to him to speak, Paul replied, "Knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. You can verify that it is not more than 12 days since I went to worship in Jerusalem, and did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple or in the synagogues or in the city. Neither can they prove to you what they now bring up against me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. So I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. Now after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. While I was doing this, they found me purified in the temple without a crowd or tumult. But some Jews from Asia, they ought to be here before you and to make an accusation, should they have anything against me, or else let these men say themselves, say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before the council, other than this one thing that I cried out while standing among them. It is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you this day." But Felix, having a rather accurate knowledge of the way, put them off, saying, "When Lysias the tribune comes down, I will decide your case." Then he gave orders to the centurion that he should be kept in custody, but have some liberty, that none of his friends should be prevented from attending to his needs. After some days, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, and he sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. And he reasoned about righteousness and self-control and the coming judgment. Felix was alarmed and said, "Go away for the present. When I get an opportunity, I will summon you." At the same time, he hoped that money would be given him by Paul. So he sent for him often and conversed with him. When 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. And desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. So last week we saw Paul in Jerusalem in a meeting with Lysias, the guy in charge of Jerusalem, right? And the Sanhedrin, who are the political Jewish leaders of that time, they came together because Lysias was trying to figure out what the heck is going on that the Jews are trying to kill Paul, right? They're trying to take him apart. And so as he was trying to figure this out, that didn't work out either, because it ended up being the same thing as it was at the temple, which basically all those people wanted to tear Paul apart. And so Paul is sent to Felix after Lysias finds out that there's a group of 40 men that want to kill Paul. And they're not going to eat or drink until he's dead. And so he sends Paul to Felix along with the letter, with this huge entourage of soldiers and horsemen, right? He's sent with a letter to tell him what exactly is going on. And this letter is going to be very important in this particular trial. And this trial against Paul and getting rid of him is really, really important to Ananias and the rest of the Sanhedrin. Because not only do they make the 5-day trek all the way from Jerusalem to Caesarea, right? But he brings along with him some of the leaders of the Sanhedrin to attend the trial. But they found it so important that they bring the spokesman, as the ESV says, named Tertullus. And it says spokesman here, but really a more accurate word would be a lawyer. So they hired out a lawyer to be able to present a case against Paul. And so as it was customary in Roman cases, as much as is customary today in trials, the prosecution goes first. They lay out all the accusations and the evidence. And then the defendant, who is Paul, has an opportunity to respond to all these accusations. And this is exactly what happens. And Tertullus, makes his case on two basic points. Okay, he makes it on two basic points. And it basically has nothing to do with what really Paul did on that particular day. The first thing that Tertullus says is that, or what he tries to do, is he wants to develop rapport with Felix. And by developing rapport with Felix, he says, you know, you're such a wonderful governor. You've done so many wonderful things, not only for the Roman Empire, but for the people of Israel. And he's hoping that by developing this relationship with Felix, that just based upon goodwill, that they would do him a favor. They would do the Sanhedrin's a favor and put Paul away. The second thing that Tertullus says, or the case that he makes, is that he tells Felix that Paul is exactly the opposite of what Felix is trying to accomplish in the nation of Israel. He is not someone that is trying to bring peace or trying to bring advancement to the country. In fact, he is a plague. He is a political plague that is stirring up riots and chaos, and he does this by example of profaning the temple that particular day. To which, you know, all the leaders, oh, yes, he's right. You know, he's got it right. And they all agree. But truth be told, he really doesn't have a case at all. And this is the reason why. The first point that he makes, the developing rapport with Felix, that Felix was this great governor of Israel, is really not true at all. And all historians would agree, or most historians would agree, that rather than being this governor who had brought peace and advancement to the nation of Israel, he was actually the complete opposite. He was probably the one governor who did most harm between the relationship between the Roman Empire and Israel, that he was probably the one reason why the nation of Israel finally revolted against the Roman Empire, which led to the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. And more than that, what he did was he brutally suppressed any sort of group that tried to revolt against him, whether they're messianic groups or they're revolutionary political groups. And so by making all of these complimentary comments toward him, what Tertullus is basically doing, he's kissing up to Felix. And he's making up all these lies, or he's flattering Felix in order to try to get him to do what the Sanhedrin want him to do. Secondly, the accusation that Paul is a leader of, he's a political agitator, that he's creating chaos, and he's a part of the Nazarene revolt, is a big fat lie, basically. Because we not only know from the narrative that Paul didn't do this, but we also know that Lysias has sent Felix a letter ahead of him, and Tertullus probably didn't know any of this, that showed that Paul wasn't doing anything wrong, criminally. And at the conclusion of what Lysias saw, is that he didn't do anything wrong that deserved imprisonment, and certainly he didn't do anything wrong that deserved any sort of death. And so on the one hand, he kisses up to Felix, and on the other hand, he pretty much makes up facts in order to try to present his case. You know, I've always found it curious that universities and state colleges who pride themselves as a place of open discussion and diversity and equality, they would violate their own principles by discriminating anyone who basically disagrees with them. And the one clear example that comes to mind of most recent events is what happened last year when the state colleges in California started to de-recognize all of these, not only just Christian organizations, but any organization that wouldn't allow an open path to leadership. So basically for the Christian organizations, they were saying, and they weren't giving up on this, was that if they were not Christian and they did not agree with the basic doctrine and constitution of the organization, that they couldn't, in good conscience, would not let them be a leader within their group. But because they felt like they were discriminating people who were of different opinion, they said, well, then we have to de-recognize you because we're a state-run organization. So that's equivalent to saying, like, the Young Republican organization. You know, they have to let a Democrat be one of their presidents or vice presidents of their particular organization. It just doesn't make sense why they would let them do that, right? And so we all know that a lot of Christian organizations, Christian organizations, they just held their ground and said, you know, if that means we're going to be de-recognized, then we're going to be de-recognized. But see, the thing is that it didn't make any sense, and they violated their own principle by discriminating against those who wanted to have a particular organization. They said, you can't do that sort of thing here, right? And so instead of being open and having diversity, they actually were going backwards in what they're trying to create. So it was just weird. I mean, when I see that stuff, it doesn't make sense, and it's weird. But the fact of the matter is that it's not uncommon. Not on the state college campus, not on college campuses, and wherever you go, it's not uncommon to see where people who say that they're all for diversity and all this stuff, that they would go against their own basic principles in order to create a society that only where their views are espoused. So no matter where you go, there's going to be caricatures, even misinformation about what, in particular, what we believe as Christians. And there is going to be discrimination against what we believe, no matter how open a place they say they are trying to create. And it's a fact of life that, you know, there are always going to be unrighteous witnesses, just like Tertullus was before Paul, that there are going to be unrighteous witnesses before us today that we're going to have to face, that either embellish things or flat out lie about what we believe, and maybe half-truths or whatever that might be. And while I think that, you know, our reactions are driven by facts, a lot of times, regardless of what side you're on, these reactions are mostly driven by emotions. They're driven by emotions like fear and anger. And not to say that emotions are bad at all, but when they're driven by fear and anger, it leads us to do things that compromise our own very principles. And so that's when we encounter these sort of unrighteous witnesses, right? And so we should not be surprised, as much as Paul was not surprised in this particular day. In our day, we should not be surprised when we face unrighteous witnesses like this. And when we do encounter them, we gotta respond the way that Paul did, with a righteous witness. And we'll see that. And we can learn a lot about a righteous witness from Paul's defense to Felix. And we all know from, if you've been here long enough at Gateway, the journey that Paul has been on. The journey that Paul has been on, that when he is in his ministry and there's been some ministry success, that every time, there are false accusations against him. There is either false imprisonment or there is beatings that follow almost to death, and then he has to move on to another place. But regardless of every instance where he's facing these particular trials, he responds with a righteous witness. And he is no different here when he is in his proper trial against what the Sanhedrins are bringing up against him. So he begins with pleasantries, right? He begins with pleasantries with Felix, and he even says that I bring my defense cheerfully before you, right, Felix. It acknowledges the fact that, yeah, you know, you've been the judge here for a long time, but he doesn't kiss up to him. And there are seven things that Paul brings up before Felix to present his case. And the first thing is that he could verify to him how long he's been in Jerusalem. From the very time that he set foot in Jerusalem to the moment that he's in that courtroom with Felix, he's been there 12 days. And he could tell you that exactly. The second thing he tells us is that his accusers, they can't prove anything that he actually stirred up any sort of trouble. The third thing that he says is that they have no proof of the charges that they're bringing against him. The next thing he says is that he acknowledged, yeah, you know, I am part of this thing called the way, but as far as you are concerned, as the Roman Empire is concerned, you know, we're just a part of a smaller group of the Jewish faith, right? We're just a smaller group of the Jewish faith. The fifth thing he says is that, you know, I came to the temple not to create trouble, but I came there to purify myself. And Lysias could attest to that as well. The next thing he says is that, you know, the Asians that were following after me and they were saying that I was causing all this trouble, well, they're not even here to say that I was causing all that trouble. And shouldn't they be here to bear witness about all the things that I was doing? And the last thing he says is that the one thing that they may have grounds to accuse me against is the fact that I said that I believe in the resurrection. But he says, you know what? That's not a criminal issue. That's more of a theological issue between me and the Jewish Sanhedrin. So that's no reason to even throw me in jail. And so even though the Sanhedrin brought their best in Tertullus, I mean, he wasn't good enough to stand up against Paul and all the facts that he brought up in his defense. And so how can we be a righteous witness? Well, let me illustrate how we can be a righteous witness by showing you how not to be a righteous witness by negative example. Okay, so if you've been on the internet lately or if you've seen on the news, you might have heard about all the brouhaha about Starbucks cups, right? I didn't notice I wrote brouhaha till now. Starbucks and their cups. And you might have heard about what happened between Starbucks. And if you've been to Starbucks, you've seen their cups. Well, it all started with a guy named Joshua Fierstein, okay? And he posted up a video on YouTube. And he says he's a Christian. He says he's an evangelist, a former pastor. Okay? And he basically said that because Starbucks took out all the symbolic, all the symbols of Christmas, somehow now Starbucks hates Jesus, right? He said that because, he also said because when you go into Starbucks, the employees aren't even allowed to say Merry Christmas to you. And so because the employees cannot say Merry Christmas to you, Starbucks now hates Jesus. And so what he said, I don't know if you've seen the video. It's like a minute and a half video. And he said, so what he says is he tricked Starbucks. He got one up on them. And he did that by saying when he went and ordered his coffee, he said that his name was Merry Christmas. And because he said his name is Merry Christmas, they wrote Merry Christmas on the Starbucks cup. And so by doing that, he brought Christmas back into Starbucks, right? And so what he was saying at the end of the video, he was saying, I want to encourage all the Christians to start a movement by bringing Christmas back into Starbucks. And he was encouraging them to say, do your own little thing and take a selfie of it by putting Christmas back onto the cups. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen or noticed the holiday cups that Starbucks brings out, but let me show you the last 2 years, okay? This is from 2 years ago. a snowman. I think this is a girl skating on ice, and a bird with an ornament. Okay, and then I think this is last year's cups. Snowflakes and more ornaments, and some looks like some leaves there. If you've been to church long enough, you know, being spiritual people, that these are all the symbols that represent Jesus' birth, right? Snowmen, snowflakes, birds who poop on trees, they are all symbols of Christmas, the real meaning of Christmas. I mean, right? I mean, they are, right? No, they're not. I mean, that's being super ridiculous. And so after I researched, I did a little bit of research on him to find out who this guy was. So I guess he does this a lot. He puts up all these like videos, short video clips, and he puts up all these video clips in order to one, talk about being a real Christian, and also secondly, to be being politically incorrect in a world where we are trying to be really politically correct. And so what he does is he's trying to do this all in the name of Jesus, to try to get other people, and Christians mostly, I think, to stand up for their faith. I don't know about you. I don't know if you heard the news or saw it on the internet and all this stuff, but this has to be one of the worst ways to be a witness of who Jesus is. And in fact, he actually posted up a video right after this, and he deleted it. He posted up a video talking about Starbucks itself, and then he started attacking Christians who were disagreeing with what he was doing. And he was saying that you can go to Starbucks and you can drink your abortion coffee, right? And he said this because Starbucks, I don't know if this is true or not, but he was saying that they support Planned Parenthood and they do all this stuff to support abortion. And so what you're doing is you're drinking your abortion coffee. And he was like pretty much slamming all the Christians that are disagreeing with him. And so all that to say, man, he's just got it all wrong to being a witness, faithful witness to who Jesus is. Because not only did he get the facts about Starbucks wrong, right? I mean, there's no symbol on these Starbucks cups ever since they were created that ever tried to espouse the real meaning of Christmas. They never took out Christmas. They were never a Christian company, right? And they don't proclaim to be so. Not only does he do that, and not only does he get the facts wrong, but he does it in an incendiary way. By instead of creating a forum for discussion and leaving people feeling like, yeah, I've been heard, and I respect your opinion, and you respect my opinion, and at the very least, we can go away respecting one another, he does it in a way where people not only are repulsed by him, but at the end of the day, people are going to be ultimately repulsed by Jesus and the Christian faith. And, you know, he's an extreme example. But think of the ways that we might be doing that on a daily basis of being an unrighteous witness. So what does a righteous witness look like? Well, a righteous witness is gracious and not divisive. A righteous witness sticks to the core of the gospel message, that Jesus is not about a cup, Jesus is not about a snowflake, or Jesus is not about what is put on, whether we put up Christmas trees or it says Happy Holidays or Merry Christmas. You stick to the core of the gospel message and not get sidetracked by these culture wars, right? A righteous witness also encourages discussion and deference for one another, rather than creating fear and anger toward one another. I mean, if you all at the end of the day, if you just get someone angry and fearful of what you're doing, you're not getting them closer to Jesus. You're probably getting them farther away from Jesus. So what does a righteous witness look like? So after what seemed like a victory for Paul, right after his case, Paul should have pretty much let Felix should have let Paul go. However, like we said last week, Felix understood very well the political climate that he was in with Israel and the Roman Empire. If you remember from last week, the political climate within Israel was really, really tense. The Israelites did not like the Roman Empire. They did not like someone being over them. And the Roman Empire was continually squashing these revolts from the Israelites. And so it was really, really tense. And so on top of that, not only was it tense, he also exacerbated the situation by brutally putting away people, killing them off if they had anything against the Roman Empire. And so he knew that he needed to make the right decision in order to balance what's going on. Because on the one hand, he didn't want to create a war, but on the other hand, he had Paul in his custody, who was a Roman citizen, and he needed to give him all the rights a Roman citizen was due. So what did he do? So he made the decision of not making a decision at all. Right? He made the decision of not making a decision at all. And so what he did was, he didn't convict Paul of any wrongdoing, right? But at the same time, he didn't let him go either. He kept him in jail. And the only silver lining through all of this is that he gave Paul some freedom in jail, and he allowed his friends to come and take care of him. So while in custody, Paul doesn't just sit there and say, woe is me, you know, I'm stuck here in jail and I'm not going to get to Rome anytime soon. But when he's given the chance to speak, he gladly comes and speaks to Felix and his wife, Drusilla. And when they ask him about what's going on, what his faith is all about, he talks to him about righteousness and self-control and about the coming judgment. He's basically sharing with him about who Jesus is and sharing the gospel, the good news, with Felix and his wife. And his response, Felix's response, is one of fear. Because he knew that he did not exemplify any of those things. And he was far from it. And we know that Felix probably didn't become a Christian because the reason why he kept calling him back wasn't necessarily because he wanted to hear more about Jesus, but he kept calling him back with the hope that maybe Paul would just slip him a 20 underneath the table. And by slipping him a 20, right, that he would just quietly let Paul go without any fanfare, and, you know, everybody would be happy. So this went on for 2 years. And every time that Felix called Paul, he gladly went and shared with him, right? And even at the 2 years, Felix didn't let him go, but as a favor to the Jews, he was kept in jail. So Paul has no idea, am I going to be let go? What does my future look like? But it doesn't matter. He's still sharing with Felix what Jesus is all about. So, just as Paul was able to share about who Jesus is, we need to do the same. But not just the facts, but in the presentation as well. Because it's not just the facts about the gospel that is going to win souls for Jesus. It's also in our presentation about the facts that is going to, about the transforming power of the gospel that is going to change people's hearts. Because even though we may not realize it, we don't present the facts on a day-to-day or minute-to-minute basis about who Jesus is and the resurrection is true and he actually walked on the earth. Even though we are not doing that, our lives are always presenting to people who Jesus is and what our faith is about. And you might not realize it, we might not realize it, but people are watching all the time. Our families are watching all the time. Our classmates are watching all the time. Our children are watching all the time. And our friends and coworkers are watching us all the time. They're watching us as to how we are different from the world if we say we are Jesus followers. And while they are watching us, and if there is nothing that is attractive or life-altering, then what reason would people have to want a piece of what we have, right? And if we don't live a life that is different from anybody else, why would they want to sacrifice their Sunday or extra nights to be a part of something that is making no change, making no difference? And why the heck would they want to come on a Sunday morning to hear some short Asian guy talk about law and order? You know, it makes absolutely no difference. There's got to be more than what seems to be a 40-minute lecture. So if we do not live with the hope that we profess, how will they know that the hope is real? Right? So it's not just about the facts. It's not just about the facts about what we believe that will change people's hearts. But it is also about the presentation of those facts that will slowly bring down the walls that are preventing people from hearing the facts themselves. So if I can encourage you today, not only to properly understand about who Jesus is and what it'll be like when we get to heaven, or you know how to properly read the Bible, not only would you place an importance on that, but you would also place an importance on how you are presenting through your life those facts before people. And it's especially important for us as we look forward to the holiday season, as we are going to spend time with our family members who a lot of times are not the easiest people to deal with. They're not the easiest people to hang out with. If you met them on the side of the street, you probably would not be friends with them had you been family members, right? And you're going to encounter that. And I would guess that a lot of them are not believers themselves. This is an opportunity for you not to shove facts down people's throats, but to present to them through your life, through the way that you respond to your weird uncle or to your abrasive cousin, right? How your life is changed by the way that you respond to them, no matter what sort of attitude they may come. And by doing that, we'll become a righteous witness, much like Paul was a righteous witness at his trial. Let's pray.